welcome to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today on our podcast, as we're here every week or so, to talk about life, the universe, and everything from a Catholic perspective. And today, I have my friend Regina Doman on. We've had Regina on in the past, back during the radio show days, and we had so much fun the last time we had
Thank
Regina
you.
On that I just figured we should do it again because, you know, it's fun. Regina, for those of you who are not familiar with her, is a Catholic wife, mother, author, and editor, not to mention writer. And currently she runs her own company, Chesterton Press. How can you lose with a name like Chesterton Press, which publishes and distributes quality Catholic fiction? She and her husband, Andrew, live in Virginia's Shenandoah Valley. A beautiful place, by the way, I must say. I have both been in the Shenandoah Valley and also have flown over the Shenandoah Valley. So I thoroughly approve. They live on a farmstead with 9 of their 10 kids. And to the question, how do you manage to get it all done? Regina responds,
what makes you think I managed to get it all done?
That's the spirit. Yes. So, what was it Chesterton said?
Thing worth doing is worth doing badly.
Even a bad shot is dignified when he accepts the challenge to a duel. And speaking of Chesterton,
yes.
Regina and I are going to be sharing a podium on the weekend of July 27th to the 29th, kind of the weekend, actually the 27th kind is of. Thursday. It all winds up on Saturday evening, but still close enough.
Nice, generous long weekend.
Yes, we're going to be at the University of Colorado Springs, actually, it's plural, for the 36th annual Chesterton Conference, the American Chesterton Society, headed by everybody's favorite Chestertonian, Dale Ahlquist, is going to be having a whole bunch of people out there. We're going to see Joseph Pierce and Father James Shaw, David Mills, he's used to edit First Things, Christopher Check, who's the president of Catholic Answers, your esteemed self, my unesteemed self, and Dale, as well as other people. And there's going to be a big crowd of people. The Chesterton Society Conference is just a hoot. Is this the first time you've been to one?
This will be my third.
Okay.
This will be my third, so I'm very excited. The first time was in the Maryland Conference, but it turned out I was like very sick the entire time. Oh. I was like seeing all these people having so much fun, and I was like, I just want to go to bed, and I have no idea why. Well, it turned out I had walking pneumonia, so there was a good excuse for it. But I wasn't able to participate as much as I could, so I made up for that when the Chesterton Conference came last year to Pennsylvania.
Okay.
And I had a blast going there. I did not speak, but I had our Chesterton Press tent. We have a gypsy tent that we bring whenever we can go someplace where we can drive to.
Okay.
And since I live in Virginia and it was in Pennsylvania, I actually brought the tent and we sold a lot of books and it was really cool. And so I said to Dale, I've got to do this again. Can you have me speak? And he said, hey, yeah, sure, we're going to Colorado. And I said, oh, fine, I'll go to Colorado, but I can't bring my tent because I can't drive there.
Okay.
I'm going there to speak, and that's pretty awesome.
Well, it is necessary to ask if, in addition to walking pneumonia, you had boogie-woogie flu. It's just so important. I can't really, it's what? Like shaving a haircut. You can't hear that.
Can't say not say it.
You can't
I did not have the boogie-woogie flu. Not at all.
Okay.
That would have been a fun kind of flu to have.
Okay.
But it was really cool because, like, the place where we were sleeping was right over where the afterglows were taking place. Because, you know, at a Chesterton conference, the afterglows are famous where people kind of sit around and talk about anything in the world for hours upon end.
It's lovely.
And so I was just so sick and I couldn't go down because I was afraid of infecting her. And I was like, that looks like so much fun.
Uh-oh.
So this at the Pennsylvania conference, not only was I able to be at the afterglows, but by the time I went to bed, my bedroom still overlooked the afterglows. And the next morning, like I went to bed, the afterglow was still going on. The next morning, I woke up and lo and behold, Joseph Pierce and some people were still going.
Really?
Had an afterglow. Yes, it went all the way through the night, at least the first night. I don't know if it went through the second night. I didn't stay up to find out.
See, it's that stalwart bulldog spirit of the English that just keeps them going like that. I am now 58 years old, and when the conference happens, I will be literally within a week of my 59th birthday.
Oh, wow.
And as an aging person, my goal will be to find my way to bed fairly early, because I'm a wuss. But
that's okay. I similar motivations for me, and I have nowhere near like your excuse.
Well, you know, 9 kids. That's a pretty good excuse. I mean, getting
But don't you have kids?
I do, but they're all grown up.
Oh.
But my kids are now at the age where they're like, don't you have to, mom and you need to like get on a plane and go somewhere so we can have the house to ourselves for some lengthy period of time. They're always happy when we go someplace. We're going to be, it's fun because we're staying out in Colorado Springs with, my friend Sherry Waddell, who lives in Colorado Springs.
Right. So is Mrs. Shea going to be there at the conference?
Yes, absolutely.
Oh, wonderful. Jen, that will be wonderful.
We went, Jan and I got to go to the, I think the 2011, I can't remember, one of those, I think it was 2011. They did one in Reno, which was hilarious.
I remember that, about it, yeah.
Yeah, because you stayed in this huge palatial casino, you know, hotel thing, and then you walk through the, you know, through the smoky casino that's full of, you know, people who have not seen the light of day for years and years because it's sitting in front of slot machines, you know, wasting away. And then you would go walk through this and step out of the casino and then into some other building, and that's where the Chesterton meeting was, you know, where they're talking about, you know, Catholic theology and fantasy and this whole Chestertonian vision of the world. That's about as polar opposite to what's going on in this casino as you could possibly.
That's amazing.
It was really amazing. So, so Jan got to come to that, and she's really looking forward to coming to this one because she wants to see Dale. She wants to see Sherry. And it will be a pleasure to introduce the two of you because I think you'd like each other a lot.
Oh, that would be so cool. Yes.
Lovely, lovely lady. So, what are you going to talk about?
I was going to ask you the same thing. Oh, my gosh. I was going to ask you, what are you talking about at the Chesterton Conference?
I'm sort of giving a Chestertonian look at the work of mercy known as Instructing the Ignorant. Which is,
that sounds good.
All the works of mercy, very much like the Beatitudes. Mm-hmm. A lot of the works of mercy are all the Beatitudes are like this. They're things that the Beatitudes pronounce a blessing on all these things that nobody wants to do.
like weep and cry and be poor and meek.
Blessed are you when men persecute you and say all manner. Sign me up for that. I'm really looking. Even the one beatitude that sounds kind of nice, which is blessed are the peacemakers, only sounds nice until you have to do it, and then everyone hates you.
And everyone hates you.
That's what peacemakers always put up with is everybody on both sides says that you're a Quisling and a traitor, and they all hate you. You know. And but that's the thing about the Beatitudes is they're all blessings on Lenten things. Blessed are you poor. Blessed are the persecuted. Blessed are the meek. Nobody wants to be meek. You want to be a badass, you know? I don't put up with all this stuff. I'm not some doormat. Meekness doesn't actually mean being a doormat, but that's what people think that it means. But a lot of the works of mercy, especially the spiritual works of mercy. The corporal works of mercy sound kind of nice.
Yeah.
Sometimes you could be a hero. I fed the hungry. Thirsty.
Who's going to argue with that?
But when you start getting into the spiritual works of mercy, instructing the ignorant sounds just so damned arrogant.
I was gonna say, it does. Yeah, it does.
I will stoop down from my Olympian height and instruct the ignorant. But that's kind of the challenge is, we do in fact have an obligation to do that. That's what the prophets spent a huge amount of time doing. And it's what Jesus spent his time doing. And, you know, he earned the reward of a grateful class of Pharisees who, you know, who are you calling ignorant? And so that's kind of the challenge that you face.
I was just talking about that with my friend too, and you know, and she was saying it is just so difficult to do without your own sort of pride, you know, because of course the response is usually bad, or not usually, but can be bad, and then you know, you have to deal with your own reaction, and that's that is really a challenge. But I cut you off. Go on.
No, well, that's talking about that, and talking about the other side of it, which is. Mm-hmm. And Chesterton really got this. This is one of the reasons that Chesterton is so appealing, is that he understood that the mother of philosophy, science, the arts, and theology is wonder. It all comes from wonder. It starts with wonder. And that's very often where instructing the ignorant begins. Sometimes, you know, instructing the ignorant really does involve, people like the prophet Isaiah having to say things like, do you not know? Have you not heard? Has it not been told to you from the beginning? So there's that dynamic that goes with it. But it begins, and it's especially fun to watch, and I'm sure you've experienced this as a homeschooling mom. It's really fun to watch little kids wonder and then start working out answers and, you know, figuring things out. So that's kind of a little pricey of where my talk is going to go.
That's pretty awesome, actually. So
how about you? What are you going to talk about?
I am going to talk about something. And I was saying to my friend today, I was talking with Michelle Hilliard, whose book you should really read because she writes on self-development. And she wrote a book about not being afraid, and it's pretty amazing.
Oh, okay.
So it was really fun to talk with her. And I said, this is either going to be a really awesome talk that will start a lot of good conversations, or I'm just going to be thrown out of my heel. because I am talking about two things, as Dale Alquist puts it, two things about Chesterton that no one wants to discuss, and I'm discussing them both in one talk.
All right.
And that is Chesterton's position on economics, which we know as distributism.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm talking about the Jewish people and Chesterton's relationship to the Jews.
Okay.
So those are the two issues that kind of are, well, I was going to say distributism can make Chesterton persona non grata in some circles.
Mm-hmm.
And even Chestertonians are uncomfortable when it comes to discussing his relationship with the Jews and the Jewish people. And I actually, at the last Chesterton conference, I have been stewing over some things regarding distributism for quite some time. And I sort of had this epiphany in the middle of the distributist panel. And I just kind of connected some dots, and that's what I'm going to be sharing, is how these dots were connected for me and what it has to do with the Jews.
Okay.
Because not to spoil the surprise of my talk, if there is a surprise or if it's not just total incoherence, if I can actually get it all on paper, I'm going to try and run it by some intelligent people so that I don't sound like an arse. But, you know, I did run it by Dale, and he thought it was worth exploring. So, but if I can talk about the Jews for a moment, I have had this lifelong love for Judaism and the Jewish people, and it was instilled in me by my parents, who were very, you know, serious, lovely Catholics. They have a very open-hearted approach to everything involving the Catholic faith, and they were, you know, welcome and wondering, recipients of the fruits of Vatican II, the Second Vatican Council. And one of the things they embraced was, you know, its teachings on ecumenism and its teachings on the Jewish people.
Yeah.
And because of that, they really just did a lot to kind of help us love Jewish customs, the Jewish language, you know, the Jewish approach to different things. And I sort of continued to go and kind of go through that, like, and, you know, appreciate even more of it as I got older. You and I have talked about one of my favorite books is Paul Johnson's A History of the Jews.
History of the Jews.
Which I call a secret history of the human race, because it just turns out when you look at the, you know, the history of the human race has just been a history of like so much evil and despair in so many ways. Like you look at history and history is really depressing, but, you know, but I read a lot of history, you know, I work as a novelist. And so, you know, in order to be a novelist, you have to understand the human person. And part of that means understanding history. And when history, when you don't understand history, it means keep on reading and reading more until you do, or at least you can try to come up with something. So I've read a lot of history. And so then when I read Paul Johnson's story, it was kind of like reading a secret history of the human race, because so much times when there was anything that was good in human history, if there was anything that brought light and brought hope and kind of lifted us up out of this morass, you know, you scratch the surface and somewhere, gall darn it, there is a Jewish person involved. It happens again and again, whether you're talking about the arts or science or philosophy or education or social justice, there is a Jewish person doing something good there and contributing some sort of usually unacknowledged heroism, you know, and then other people take it and run with it. And they're the ones that we remember. So a lot of times it doesn't show up in the conventional histories, but if you actually go back and study the Jews and see what they were doing at any one time in history, you know, by and large, it is a history of like light and hope and unappreciation by the outside world.
And astonishing contributions to the human race.
Know, so I mean, it was like, it can be a very heartbreaking history, but it's a very beautiful history, you know, and a lot of times they don't ask for credit for these things. You know, and it's also a very sad history because as a Catholic, you know, the history of the Jews and the Catholics is also a very sad history. And one of the ways I want to say that we should look at it, because it's very difficult reading. You know, you read about the stuff that Catholics have done to Jews, you know, and it's very difficult reading. But what the way I choose to see it is it's kind of like in getting an inside window on a very bitter, very long family quarrel. Because one of the reasons why it is so bitter is because Jews and Catholics, like, we're joined at the hip.
We're
the twins struggling in the womb. I think it was Dietrich von Hildebrand said, that was the image he had. Were the unborn twins struggling in the womb? You know, like, who was it? There were twins in the womb that struggled in the Old Testament. I'm thinking, was it Jacob and Esau? I can't remember. But there's a pair of twins, and they were struggling in the womb. He said, that's what Catholics and Jews are like, because really, we are so connected. And so the hurts between us hurt each other so much. And part of, I think, this is what I'm going to say, what Vatican II was able to do, was sort of able to, as a result of the Holocaust and as a result of, you know, self-examination on the part of some very heroic popes and church leaders, we were able to kind of take a step back from that and say, okay, let's look here. Let's look at this from the outside and let's acknowledge what's going on here and let's try to start again. You know, let's acknowledge what we've done wrong and let's try to start again. Let us try to get this right. Now, and it's kind of amazing. So like you look at the history of the relations between the Jews and the Catholic Church. If you, for any reason, whether it be liturgical or philosophical or something, you see fit to reject the Second Vatican Council, you are rejecting a huge chunk of what has happened in the Church's relationship with the Jewish people. You really are.
Absolutely. You're really, I would argue, you are rejecting practically the first thing to happen since the split between the synagogue and the church in the first century. It's been famously said that, you know, up until the Second Vatican Council, essentially what you had happening was not a dialogue. You had two monologues.
Going on.
Catholics telling Jews what they thought, and Jews just kind of mostly just keeping their head down and trying to stay out of the way of whatever it was Christians were going to do to them, you know?
Themselves, though, the Jews said some really nasty things. You know, and it's in the Talmud. Do you know what I mean? Like, the stuff that they wrote about Christians in the Talmud is really kind of nasty stuff.
Sure.
You know, and that was the thing. And actually, and the church fathers, you look at what they said about the Jews, and it was really nasty stuff.
Right. So that's actually the way everybody talked in those days. And you find, you know, you find Christians and Christians arguing with each other sometimes in just the ugliest ways, which itself bore fruit, if you want to call it that, in the religious wars of the 16th century.
It's true. Well, actually, you know, it's kind of funny. This is what Paul Johnson says. We learned that from the Jews, because the Jews, when they talk among each other and like they attack one another's intellectual position, they did use really nasty words, you know, and they did kind of excommunicate each other. And they said, and, you know, and the Christians built right on top of that. Like they just took Jewish tradition of polemics, such as it was, and they kind of used that.
Yeah.
So in a certain sense, it gives you a window into like the internet wars that's going on today to bring this down to the point. You know how we're all cocooning and just talking to ourselves?
Right.
You know? And but the problem is anything you put on the internet is published. Like it's published. Like that's what the internet is. It's for publishing stuff. And anything you like type onto the internet and post up there, that can be used against you in a court of law.
Mm-hmm.
And in the same sort of way, the things that the church fathers wrote down, and maybe they wrote them down at a huge hurry when they had lost their temper, you know, and maybe like that's when the Jewish rabbis wrote things down when they had lost their temper. Those things got preserved and they got handed down. Mm-hmm. And so whenever either a Jew or a Catholic would sort of have a conversion, recover their faith, want to go back to the roots and want to get really serious about their faith, they'd read the scriptures and then they'd start to read the writings on the scriptures, you know, the Jewish commentary on the scriptures, the Catholic commentary on the scriptures, and they would uncover all this stuff, these internet battles, as it were, of the first couple centuries. And they'd be like, and they wouldn't have the context.
Yeah.
They wouldn't have the tones of voice. They wouldn't have that. And they would be like, oh my gosh, you know, these people, my intellectual opponents, they're truly from hell. Like they're truly demonic. They're truly hellish.
Yeah.
And the whole thing would start all over again. And so the misunderstandings, ironically, the closer individual Jews and Catholics got, you know, to their religion, the more in love with the religion they fell, the more the animus continued, you know, and it's really, really sad.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really, really tragic because it sort of widened the gulf, you know, between us in that way.
Yeah,
and so that was,
I was once at a party, this is years ago, I had a friend who was visiting us from Britain. And it was summertime. We had a family friends who were part of this little homeschool group that we belonged to. So it was mostly evangelicals plus us, the Catholic family, and also a woman who was the wife of an Orthodox priest that lives in the area. And she was a convert.
Yeah.
And so she had been trying to find some history books for her kids. And so she wrote away to this publisher that she didn't know anything about for a history textbook. Well, it turned out that the publisher was Bob Jones University.
Oh no.
And so she got this textbook and it had, you know, it was a hilarious commentary. It had like a picture of an Orthodox priest baptizing a baby. And the caption on it was something like, you know, ignorant, paganized, you know, pseudo Christians performing magical rituals on their children. So she thought, I'm not going to give this to my kids. So she closed the book up and sent it back. And so she was lamenting her struggles to find a decent history textbook. So we went to this barbecue thing that they had at her husband's parish. And I was there with my friend Graham, who was visiting from England. And I remembered that there was going to be a Catholic homeschool conference happening next town over from our town. So I walked up to her and said, hi, Mary, I just wanted to introduce you to my friend Graham, you know, so they exchanged pleasantries. And I said, oh, by the way, I just want to let you know there's going to be a Catholic homeschool conference up in Everett. And I thought you might be interested because you might be able to find some kind of, you know, decent, halfway decent history textbooks there. I heard you lamenting about trying to find a decent history textbook for your kids. She looks at me and goes, "Well, you Catholics have trampled all over the Orthodox. What about the sack of Constantinople in 1204?
Yes. Well, you know, it's a real thing.
Oh,
and I learned about the sack of Constantinople from my Orthodox friends. You're right. It's a real thing.
Oh,
and it really did hurt Ryuk.
It was a terrible thing, but it was like, I'm sorry we sacked your city. I promise it won't happen again. I really regret it. You know, and Graham, being English, just sort of quietly receded from the conversation, you know, while this was going on. But it was one of those things where, you know, these historical grievances, you do see things on the internet, and you're right, they're like old internet flame wars. I think one of the most...
It's a big cautionary tale, isn't it?
Oh, well, yeah, I think one of the most potent drugs ever pumped into medieval Europe was the invention of the printing press, because all of a sudden you got people. It was if reading 16th century religious quarrels is like reading the internet today. And you got these guys who became superstars. Luther was one of them. He was turned out to be just an absolutely brilliant pamphleteer, you know, but you got a lot of these people. And some of the pamphlets are hilarious. There was a pamphlet that's written, two of my favorite titles for a 16th century pamphlet. One is called 200 Great Fat Well-Swilled Papistical Lies.
Oh,
how's that for a title?
That's awesome.
That's just so great.
Yeah.
But there's also there's one by John Knox that was written to protest Mary of England, called A First Blast of the Trumpet Against the Monstrous Regiment of Women in the Land. See, those are the days when they they used to write things like that. But yeah, so you got people who engage in these sort of epistolary struggles with one another that are very much like internet flame wars. Today, and you're right, it results not in the free exchange of ideas, it results in what you called cocooning, and that's exactly right. People who, I'm here to listen to people tell me things that I already think and believe. I am not interested in what you've got to say, and in fact, the fact that you say it means that it's false. You know,
it's true. It is a big problem. And I mean, it's the internet thing. I mean, that gets the result of kind of like letting the technology sort of have its head. But I mean, it's dangerous, you know, taking and things like that. I mean, there's body counts associated with those things. You know what I mean? Like, because, you know, a couple of saints had at it with a local rabbi and happened to write it down. And, you know, and then that got transferred and got transferred. That means pogroms in Germany or in Russia, you know, because people read that stuff and it's still incendiary.
Right.
I mean, the stuff that we write down on a daily basis, it can really come down to bite us, you know. It can really come back to bite us in that way.
Mm-hmm.
I remember telling this to my kids. I'm just like, I know that you're also like an internet pioneer, and so was my husband and I. You know, he was doing web servers back in when it first came out, and we had to tell our young teenagers. We were like, look, anything you post on this device, on this computer or whatever, anything here can be used against you in a court of law. It is publishing. It can come back to bite you.
Mm-hmm.
And the other piece of advice I gave them, by the way, more recently, was never, ever get into an argument with an Orthodox. Just don't. I said, if they want to talk at you, just sit there and nod your head and look very sad. And do it. I would say do what you did. Just say, I'm really sorry. Because, you know, there is no... It's like, I think it's an old family quarrel, and there's really nothing defensible. You know what I mean? Like, I would just basically say, maybe there are historical things you could say back, but, you know, it's not going to make any difference. So this person obviously has a grievance, and just let them like, hear what they have to say, because it's important.
Well,
and if
you
we
know,
don't forgive each other, we can't move on.
One of the things that I have discovered over time, of course, is that, you know, a lot of those quarrels don't, in a funny way, they don't have to do with theology.
No.
I find that I was having a conversation yesterday about this. There is a personality type that I have run into in my own communion, among the Orthodox. I've run into it with fundamentalists. I've run into it with atheists. And you certainly can run into it with Muslims. You can run into it in Judaism, and it really has. It's not about the theology. It's about a personality type, usually male, typically unmarried. And he's that guy who just knows that he's right and he's spoiling for a fight. And
You know, and
you know
it's a
that
shame.
guy? Yeah.
It's a shame that we don't have a culture of genuine debate. We don't have really,
Right.
you know, like you look at Chesterton and the way he went head to head with some of the great minds of his day, and people would pay to see it, you know, but there was this lovely etiquette to it, and there was a structure, and so it would actually enjoyable. And you know, you can say that that kind of forwarded the conversation. Well, we don't have that anymore. You
Yeah.
know, we don't have etiquette. We don't have, you know, we don't have that sort of, you know, you get into those conversations and no one knows the rules anymore. So on the one hand, it's like that's all that lovely male energy with, if it were put into, directed in the right way, could actually produce some good, or at least some good entertainment. It makes some great TV maybe, you know, but we don't have that culture of debate anymore. And we're rapidly losing the kind of common grounds that we have, you know?
Well, and I certainly fall prey
And
to
again, that brings us back to Chesterton, because he, I think if we're going to recover that, we should look to Chesterton,
Yeah,
you
because
know?
he could really do that. It's certainly something I admire about him. I wish I were better at it because I certainly fall prey to this kind of stuff.
I can't think on my feet. Yeah. My problem is like, I'm like, I find when I'm in debates like that, I find myself like Tevye, you know, Tevye and Laura in Fiddler on the Roof. You know, it's like the one person says something and I'm like, he's right, you know, and then somebody contradicts him and I'm like, he's right, you know, and the guy says to Tevye, he's like, he's right and he's right. They can't both be right. And I'm like, you are also right. You know, I'm just like, I rather watch a debate than contribute to it because I just don't think fast enough. I can do it in writing and if I can edit a couple times, but I am not that public person to do it.
If it's
But
something
Chesterton's, that's a
that I've
high
given
bar.
thought to, what amazes me about Chesterton is that he can come to things very often fresh
That wonder.
and can
Yeah.
see, you know, he can see what's going on, and he has an ability to do that. I have to think about things for like several years before the obvious finally dawns on me.
Sounds on me. Yeah.
And
Yeah.
so
I'm yeah. And part of it is, well, you know, with Chesterton, you know, we have a sort of subtle documentation of his own spiritual struggles in a book like Man Alive, you know, where here's a guy who is like full of wonder, but what does he have to do to produce that wonder? He has got to walk around the world. He has got to court his wife over and over again. And that sort of gives you a window into how hard, how difficult Chesterton must have found it to not just kind of look his opponent and say, oh, you're just you know, F you or whatever. Do you know what I mean? Like he must have really found it a struggle to keep that attitude of wonder and to keep that sort of reverence and respect for the human person. You know what I mean? Like he makes it look so easy because he's a genius, but I feel like the novels give us insight that no, it didn't come easy to him. That was something he had to work with by the grace of God.
Well, and
And
it came out of real tremendous personal crises too.
true, yeah.
You know, this is somebody who really did come within an inch of suicide.
Yeah. And
And
whose future brother-in-law did commit suicide too. Yeah.
right, and who, you know, had to endure the death of his brother at just the
Yeah.
moment where his own health had failed him, where he, I mean, he was in a coma, you know,
Yeah.
for several weeks. And so he went through his own share of suffering. But you know,
True. Yeah.
also one of the I think about sometimes, I think if you want to call this an advantage,
Go on.
Chesterton is looking at the 20th century through a telescope at the beginning.
Yeah.
Our look at the 20th century is in bitter, bitter hindsight.
Yes.
He's warning, you know, he's writing books like Eugenics and Other Evils saying this is coming. Be careful of this stuff because it's going to kill millions of people. He writes The End of the Armistice in 1934, and he can see where Nazi Germany is going. But
he sounds the alarm.
But he only lives until 1936.
Before Kristallnacht, I think,
Yeah, Kristallnacht didn't happen for another 2 years. And so, you know, the death camps haven't been built.
Well, not in Germany, but in Russia, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So
Gulag was up. Yeah.
Right. So he's seeing those things, but he's seeing them with foresight. And so he's warning.
Yeah.
But, you know, we've been through the trauma now. In fact, our parents went through the trauma. We have heard of the trauma by the hearing of the ear. We have the movies. We've seen the films of the, you know, the heaps of bodies and all of that. But it's already fading.
Yeah. It's already being questioned and doubted. And are people really that evil? Yeah.
And so you run into all of those kinds of things, you know, the flat earthers or the, you know, the Holocaust version of the flat earthers. Who are saying it never happened and all of that, or it can never happen again, as though, you know, we're immune from the fall, you know. That's, I think that's also, that's a factor that Chesterton didn't have to deal with. That it's one thing to be confronted with those who say that will never happen, because who would believe the Holocaust before it happened? Who could believe that something like that would be done? In addition to being monumentally evil, it was just freaking crazy. There was a book that was written in 1913 by a guy named Norman Angell. Called The Grand Illusion. And in The Grand Illusion, what Norman Angell said was, there will never be a major European war, because if that happened, why, that would destroy Europe and it would cause international economic catastrophe. That would be insane to do. Who would do something like that, right?
Isn't that funny?
And in the same way, you know, the great warning of the 20th century has been, you know, people saying, come on, you know, nobody's that bad. Nobody's that crazy. You know, surely Hitler will act in his own interests and not, commit himself to a two-front war and then commit more resources to the Holocaust and the Nazis. You know, in addition to things like the Holocaust, which was, in addition to being evil, was phenomenally stupid from a military perspective.
From every point of view.
Because it took huge resources to do this. To what purpose? And while they're spending money on this, what's also not known today is that the Nazis spent more money, I'm not making this up, they spent more money searching for the portal to the hollow earth than we did on the Manhattan Project. Just phenomenally crazy things.
Well, the other thing, like the German program to educate dogs and help them to speak. That was another thing.
Yeah.
That was a Nazi thing.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But I mean, yeah, like, you know, what was it? Hitler himself was a teetotaler. He wouldn't drink alcohol. He was a vegan, you know, wouldn't eat animal products and stuff, you know, like that. And I mean, he had a whole animal rights activist.
Right.
You know, I mean, he was so crunchy, you know, for to use the term. I mean, it's crazy.
Yeah, straining. This is what we call straining at gnats and swallowing camels. But yeah, so, you know, we see this now from the other end, and we say it really is possible for a civilization to go mad. And so when we see a civilization starting to go mad, we get edgy.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's true. I mean, and with good reason, you know?
Yeah.
It's, I mean, well, there's also the one thing that hopefully the Holocaust will teach us, you know, is that the enemy, you know, the devil wants to kill Jews. He just wants, like, he has never forgiven the Jews for, you know, bringing the Messiah to the world. Mm-hmm. We can never thank them enough, mm-hmm. and the devil can never hate them enough.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you put your hands into the power of yourself, into the, you know, into the hands of Satan, you're going to end up killing Jews one way or another for the most ridiculous of excuses.
Mm-hmm.
You will end up killing Jews.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it's just absolutely crazy. You know, mm-hmm. the stuff that when you read the lives of those who hate the Jews, you know, they all sort of, you know, they'll lose everything. Mm-hmm. But still have to persecute Jews, you know? I mean, there really is, it kind of tells you, it is an intellectual disease, you know, because Satan is a higher intelligence, and he's very smart, mm-hmm. and he can give you any sort of argument to convince you to hate the Jews. You know, mm-hmm. he has every resource at his disposal to convince you intellectually to do this. Mm-hmm. But then when it comes down to it, he'll abandon all reason, just so long as Jews die, you know? So long as Jews die, or, you know, individual Jews are corrupted, he will just, you know, give you the power to do that. Yeah. It's a very scary thing, and it should be a very real thing.
Yeah.
You know, so sometimes, you know, I run into occasionally, you know, Catholics or other people who have fallen into anti-Semitism, which is a real disease. Like it's like a virus, you know, you stare at it too long and you start thinking that way, you start catching it. And, you know, it is a real spiritual thing. It's kind of like one of those things Chesterton says that, you know, you really can't argue it. You just have to, like pornography, it's a snake to be trodden upon,
yeah.
not an idea to be argued with.
Right. Yeah. Know? Yeah. Well, this sounds like it's going to be a typically vivacious Chesterton conference. So, you know, just another humdrum talk about something that nobody cares
about. Nobody else cares
not,
about.
Not
oh,
get
my
anybody,
gosh.
Anybody talking or anything. So.
Yeah, good. That's what I'm hoping. Well, my brother, who is a priest in the Diocese of Colorado, is hopefully going to come and join me there.
Oh, goody.
So, and that should be pretty awesome. Yes, he's a lover of Chesterton.
All
so.
Right. Well, tell him to get all signed up, you know. And by the way, if
yes,
you're out there in podcast land, so here's the deal. You can sign up to come to the 36th annual Chesterton Conference out there in podcast land. Just go online and Google Chesterton 36th Annual Conference. It'll take you right to the page, and you can get yourself all signed up, and you will be happy you did. You should come. It'll be great. Colorado Springs, awesome. By the way, is a really cool place. You're going to be, I think there's going to be some treks out to the Garden of the Gods, which is really awesome.
Really?
Well, Colorado Springs sits on what was the shore of an ancient inland sea.
Oh my gosh.
During the Jurassic and Cretaceous period.
Mm-hmm.
And so it laid down a lot of sandstone, just sand that collected, you know, at the bottom of the sea. Then the sea receded, and the North American plate proceeded to push up against the Pacific plate and create the Rocky Mountains. And so, among other things, what happened was these great beds of red sandstone split, and over time, they slowly were pushed into an upright position. So you got these
wow.
plates of red sandstone that just stick up in the early morning light. It's one of the most beautiful things you'll ever see. So,
oh, wow.
Garden of the Gods, it's super cool. Yeah,
okay.
we were there a couple of years ago with Sherry. We had a wonderful time. And
oh, my gosh.
Had a chance to poke around. Also, if you can get out to Manitou Springs, which is up the mountainside from Colorado Springs. Colorado Springs sits right at the foot of Pikes Peak.
Isn't that where Focus on the Family is?
Yes, it is.
Springs?
Yep.
Ah,
Focus on the Family is there. Oh, that reminds me. Paul McCusker, who is the creator of Adventures in Odyssey, he's going to be there.
Love his. He's going to be there. Ah,
yes.
I love it. I'm a fan. Total yeah. fan. That's awesome.
Philip,
never met him. That's
Philip
cool.
Glossman. The evil Philip Glossman.
Who's the evil Philip?
Philip Glossman is the character that Paul McCusker played when he wasn't writing
really?
Adventures in Odyssey. He was playing evil Philip Glossman.
You learn something new every day.
Yes,
oh, that's
right.
pretty awesome.
So anyway, yeah, so Paul McCusker will be there, and that'll be fun. And and your brother, Father Doman, will be
Father
there.
Father Joseph Doman.
Yes.
Yes. And his new religious order, he didn't start it, but he's just joining a religious order, and I'm hoping that they'll come there too.
They are
the servants of, oh dear, we always just call them the servants. Now I'm forgetting. I can't remember the servants of the eternal word, or they're servants of something good. I know that. It has to do with Christ and Our Lady, but I can't remember. That's okay. So terrible. Joseph, if you're listening to this, I'm sorry. I've got to write it down.
The servants of something good. That would be a great.
Well, it's got to be someone good, someone great, someone holy.
Okay.
Oh, man. I've got to Google that now. I'm like, what is that thing? Servants of.
You're listening to Connecting the Dots, where Regina Doman is bringing shame on her family.
And, thanks a lot, Mark.
Just here to help. So
I'll send you the link, and you can put it below the podcast so that my brother doesn't like totally excommunicate me.
He can't do that. So I suppose he could refuse to hear your confession or something.
That's true. I guess he could.
That's got to be dodgy feeling. Have you ever had to make a confession to your brother? Or is that one of those things where you just invoke the any priest will do clause and go anywhere else?
Well, you know what? Actually, one of the first things that happened after my brother was ordained is my dad went to him for confession.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's my dad, though.
He
has a lot of guts. And he was like, yeah. And that sort of set the tone, you know? So I don't know if I have been to him. I probably would go if it comes to that. But him being out in Colorado, he doesn't always know what's going on in my life. So, and it'd be great to be able to tell him, and then he wouldn't be able to comment on it or anything like that.
Well, see, that's I was just going to say there are real advantages here. So you go to your brother for confession. He can never tell your mom.
That's true.
I mean, how great is that? That's really great. You know,
it's actually pretty cool.
A lot of advantages. Yeah. So, I don't actually have any. Well, I'm the only Catholic in my family of origin, so I don't really have any of those advantages. I have no relatives that are priests, but
you could have a son who becomes a priest, I suppose.
I could do that. I've got to start pressuring somebody to do that. I saw some article the other day. I wrote about this, some guy saying that the sole goal of Catholic parenting is to raise children to be priests, monks, and nuns. And if they don't become priests, monks, or nuns, then you have failed as a Catholic parent. I have strong views on such crazy theory.
Well, you know what's kind of funny? I love my sister, Alicia Hernan. She and her husband do this wonderful podcast, which you should totally look up, called Messy Parenting.
Okay.
And one of the lines that I'm going to butcher this, but Alicia said it. One of my favorite lines that Alicia had once said is somebody said to her, well, you know, as a Catholic parent, your job is to raise your children to become saints.
Uh-huh.
And she's like, heck with it. I'm hoping my children will make me a saint. I'm leaving them out of it. You know, my job as a Catholic parent is to become a saint through raising my children.
Okay.
I'm hoping that they'll make me saints. I have no hope of making them a saint or something like that.
Okay.
And she managed to say it a lot more elegantly than that. But that is, to me, that has always struck me as the correct attitude.
Okay.
You know, I am here to become sanctified through raising you, you know, and hopefully it'll be mutual, you know, and hopefully we'll both get holy together. That's always struck me as the right way to look at things.
I think all of us becoming saints is the optimal win-win situation. And certainly if God is calling your kid to be a priest, monk, or nun, then great. But the idea that if they don't, then you have failed. And by extension, of course, what's also being spoken there is they have failed as human beings, and as Catholics, that I look at and I'm going, well, okay, but Justin Martyr was a lay person, and Thomas More was a lay person, and St. Gianamola was a lay person, and, you know, what are we, chopped liver? I mean,
Well, you know, and it's true, actually, in it, you know, you don't know in God's plan. Maybe it is really God's plan that you could really screw up if you didn't marry the person he wants you to marry.
Sure.
You know, because maybe he has plans for your kids. Like my parents, both of them discerned the religious life before marriage. In fact, my mom didn't even bother to ask God. She was so sure she was going to become a nun that she just kind of, you know, was just like, oh, well, of course, this is what God wants. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until she was actually dating my dad that it suddenly like dawned on her that he might actually have a different plan, you know? Yes. And when she finally asked God, you know, she realized like he basically led her through a series of circumstances to realize that that was emphatically not what he wanted her to do. And that she could really like lose, maybe not her soul, but at least her zeal and her fervor for God if she became a nun. And she could also make other people's lives really miserable if she became a nun because of mm-hmm. her own faults and failings. Because she basically said, you know, I realize as a strong woman, you know, who got along well with other women, I could totally manipulate women to do whatever I wanted them to do. But she's like, you know what? I always had a hard time dealing with men. And you know what? I thought it would be good for me to be in a relationship with man, a man who I had to like look up to and respect and, you know, yes, sometimes submit and obey. Mm-hmm. And she thought, you know what? That would probably make me holier. And at that moment, it was like she realized that her vocation was marriage. And thank God she did, or I wouldn't have been here, you know?
It turned out well yeah. for you, you know?
Yeah. And so it was a huge insight. And fortunately, my dad, as soon as he set eyes on my mom, he knew that she was the one. So fortunately, she had that insight. So praise God for that.
Yeah. Yeah. Fantastic. Hey, I just want to ask, we're getting close to the end here, but I wanted to ask.
Yeah.
Your most recent publishing project, what is it and where can people get it?
Find it. Well, my most recent publishing project is actually not yet for sale because for the past 10 years or so, I've been working on a series of novels that has to do with the Jewish people, big surprise, which is
How
one of the reasons
that?
Why I've
okay.
been thinking about that. I've been doing, yeah, like a biblical sort of novel series and yeah. King David's involved and Adam and Eve are involved and it's going to be really cool if I ever get around to finishing it. But that's one of the reasons why I've been doing a lot of research in history and stuff and, you know, reading a lot of Jewish mythology and Jewish history and folktales. It's really amazing stuff. It's so great that, again, Vatican II has reconnected us with that those traditions, especially yeah. in the realm of biblical studies, because, you know, Jewish insight into the scriptures, which is so much older than our Catholic insights in the scripture, uh-huh. is just amazing. And reconnecting with that tradition has been just amazing for my spiritual life in reading the scriptures, as well as very inspirational for my novel. But you all have to just pray for me with that I actually find some time amidst raising all these children and homeschooling them very badly, that I actually have time to, you know, write this. I actually teach part-time now in our homeschooling co-op, so I take my summers to try to work on that. Yeah, which is pretty awesome. But
writing?
By the way, I've been frantically Googling my my brother's. I've been Googling Joseph Doman, Denver, Colorado, and Denver, Colorado religious. And I think I have it. I think that it's the Servants of Christ Jesus. I'm pretty sure that's the religious order he's joining. And if I'm wrong, it's you know because that would fit because it is Servants of something good. You know, someone good. So okay. Servants of Christ Jesus.org or scjesus.org is where you want to go to find out about that order. It's an order
All right.
of priests.
Very good.
But my most recent thing would be actually my first nonfiction book, No Longer Strangers, which is up on my website at chestertonpress.com. I wrote it with a TOR priest, Father Gregory Plow, and we wrote it to kind of document Father Mike Scanlon, may he rest in peace, his mm-hmm. efforts to start households at the Franciscan University of Steubenville. As some of you might know, Father Mike Scanlon was the friar who was responsible for revitalizing Franciscan University, mm-hmm. And he just recently passed.
Yeah.
And so this was a book that we actually had written before he passed about his legacy of households. And it's, from my point of view, I like the topic because it's very sociological. I like to see when communities work, you know, Benedict option things or whatever, they mm-hmm. tend to vanish. They tend to recede and we forget about them, you mm-hmm. know, like a good family. You
right.
know, when you have a good family, when you have a good community, it recedes into the background and the individuals stand out because mm-hmm. it's done what it needed to do. You know, like a good plant, it bears fruit and then it kind of withers away naturally, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And for many people, communities, the community of households were functioning and happy and healthy communities that actually did what they were supposed to do. So the bad part of it from a historical point of view is that we're in danger of forgetting that, mm-hmm. you know, because we can forget good things as well as bad things. Mm-hmm. So Father Gregory Plough wanted to kind of take some time on the occasion of the 40th anniversary of households to kind of document what actually went on there. And it was a fascinating project to try to put down what actually worked and what actually was very balanced and healthy and life-giving about households. So anyhow, it's called No Longer Strangers, because the benefit of living in a functional, you know, Christian community is that you are not strangers with yeah. people, you know, that you live with. They, you can know them and be known by them, and that can bring life. And so you can go off and do amazing things, you yeah. know, and the community like recedes into the background, and no one writes exposés on it, and nobody fulminates about it on the internet, because you know what, like a good family, like good parents, they just did what they were supposed to do and then just got off the stage, you know?
Yeah.
So anyhow, that's one thing I could promote, because that came out last year, No Longer Strangers, and it's okay. at trustedfrompress.com.
That is so cool. Well, I want to thank you so much, Regina Doman, for being on Connecting the Dots today.
Oh, my gosh. And it was always so fun, Mark. Thank you.
I look forward to crossing paths with you when we get to Colorado Springs at the American Chesterton Society Conference, July 27th to the 29th. Be there. Aloha, all of you out there in Connecting the Dots land. Thanks so
yes,
much.
Please do.
And we will talk to you guys next week. Bye-bye.